Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We've got a lot on tap for you today. I'm solo, and I'm going to talk about, in just a few moments, about a 111-year-old secret to a long life. You may be surprised. Also, we'll talk about the health benefits of peppermint, and what's the scientific basis for how peppermint seems to work, especially in gastrointestinal ailments. It's a premium GI remedy, and we're going to take a look at that in just a moment. But first, I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview of my Intelligent Medicine newsletter blog for the week. You can subscribe to the Intelligent Medicine newsletter if you haven't already by emailing us to radioprogram@AOL.com. Just state that you want to be on the newsletter mailing list. We're not going to put you on a mailing list for all kinds of products. You won't be bombarded with advertisements. You're just going to get a free newsletter every week, and I hope you'll find it interesting. The question of the week that I pose in my blog in the Intelligent Medicine newsletter is, what do Bill Gates, eggs, and Soylent Green have in common? All right, anybody remember the movie Soylent Green? It's an old clunker of a movie, a sci-fi movie starring Charlton Heston in the days where he was buff and he wore, you know, he went shirtless a lot or wore too tight T-shirts. And it also features Edward G. Robinson, by the way, in his final screen role. Also, Joseph Cotton makes an appearance in that. The Rifleman, Chuck Connors. Remember, some of you were older when you were a kid. Chuck Connors was a popular guy. Well, he's in the movie Soylent Green, and it's from 1973. And I don't know what possessed me to rewatch Soylent Green, but it's a dystopian sci-fi movie. And it's, I mean, think about it, it's kind of silly because it's a long movie and it's got a punchline at the end that's supposed to be a surprise ending, but it's easy to guess what's going to be at the end of the line when you get to the, with the payoff at the end of the movie. And by the way, spoiler alert here, cover your ears. The idea is that this is the year 2022, and New York has become so crowded and impoverished that something like 40 million people live in New York City. And the resources are vanishing, the air is polluted, people are crowded into dormitories because it's just an overpopulation nightmare. And they clamor for their rations of a food called Soylent Green. These are synthetic square wafers, kind of like oversized communion wafers that are green colored. And at the end of the movie, the payoff line, and it's just so obvious, you could see it coming from a mile away. It turns out that Soylent Green is actually made from people. So what they do is they take people and they offer them euthanasia, and they give them a pleasant way of dying and a final meal, which is a meal of like standard food, because in 2022, there's not enough money for everybody to get, or enough resources for everybody to get standard food. So you eat a lot of synthetic food like Soylent Green. But if you want to die early and contribute your body to science or have it reprocessed into Soylent Green, they give you this wonderful meal, a meal of your choice, and they give you symphonic music, and they give you pleasant drugs, and then you die a pleasant death, and then they take you to the meat processing factory and turn you into Soylent Green. Or alternatively, if you're rioting in the streets, there's lots of civil disorders, they have these big garbage trucks that are, they're so funny, they're like 1970s New York City garbage trucks. I remember from way back when I lived in New York City. And what they do is, instead of scooping up garbage, they scoop up people, and the people get thrown into the hopper and then ground up and taken to the Soylent Green factory. But what's interesting in that movie Don't worry, I'm going to get to this. Be patient with me here. In 2022, nobody can remember what real food used to taste like. Remember, this is a movie done in 1973. It's about what things are going to be like in 2022. Let's do the math here. It's 2013, so 2022 is only 9 years off. It's not so far-fetched. Nobody can remember what real food used to taste like. So Edward G. Robinson, in a reverie about, you know, he's hungry, he's thinking about food. His character reminisces, quote, "I was there. I can prove it. When I was a kid, you could buy meat anywhere. Eggs they had, real butter, not this crap." And so a lot of this is about longings for things past. All right, now, shifting gears. Let's fast forward from 1973 to 2013, a mere 40 years later. We now have multi-zillionaire Bill Gates, who is basically out of a job because he's made so much money by the age of 50 or so that he's retired and he's on a mission to change the world, improve the world. You know, he can't spend his money fast enough. And he's teamed up with another really rich guy, Peter Thiel. These are a couple of Silicon Valley colleagues, Bill Gates and Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is the originator of PayPal. So every time you click on PayPal, he gets like a royalty, right? So he's got more money than he can ever spend. And they've got this new project. They're going to bankroll something called Beyond Eggs. And here's a description of what the Beyond Eggs project is going to do. It's supposed to combat hunger in the third world, revolutionize food production, save the planet, and do a lot of good. So I'm quoting here, "Why would anyone want to make an egg replacement in the first place? Well, beyond the ethical quandaries of the current food industry, extracting protein from meat and other animal-based products is horribly inefficient. By the time the world's population reaches 9 billion in 2050, we'll need better ways of making edible protein. Animal agriculture is also one of the leading contributors to climate change. More sustainable solutions like Beyond Eggs reduce the need for chicken feed, including corn and soy, which means less carbon emissions. Along with the current cooking and baking substitute, Tetrick's team," the guy who developed this is named Tetrick, "is also developing egg-free mayonnaise in a formula for scrambled eggs." This comes to us from something called motherboard.com. And by the way, global philanthropists, among them the executives who run Twitter, which is about to go public for billions of dollars in equity, they're also bankrolling a new product to be dubbed Beyond Meat. So is this beginning to sound a little bit like we're moving towards the Soylent Green era? Well, we're not grinding up people yet. The ingredients are going to be vegetarian ingredients that are mostly like legumes and plant ingredients that can be grown in a variety of countries that now face critical food shortages and can be produced more cheaply than eggs. And best of all, says the originator, Josh Tetrick, they have bested Mother Nature by creating a tasty, versatile protein source that contains absolutely no cholesterol or saturated fat. So what could be better than that? It's cheaper, it's healthier for the environment, it's cruelty-free because we're not keeping chickens cooped up in cages laying eggs, and there's none of that bad cholesterol or saturated fat. So here's a quote from this guy, Josh Tetrick. He says, "What we want to do eventually is find a way to work with farmers in the developing world to enable them to have new cash crops that can be used. Then we become the kind of company to be feared by the bad guys in the industry." So presumably he means bad guys are the big agribusiness conglomerates that coop up animals and they pollute the environment. And you know, it's both animal poop and the methane that animals exhale into the atmosphere that is hastening climate change, according to the scheme. And also, those eggs are bad for you anyway, right? They clog people's arteries with fat and cholesterol. So what an improvement. Well, the trouble is that while eating lower in the food chain may have some merits, I mean, there's no question that when you make animal protein, that's high in the food chain, it's energy intensive. It involves a lot of land. There's a potential for pollution. That consideration aside, and by the way, you know, I think that there's this guy named Malthus who came up with the idea that humans were going to make themselves extinct because they're multiplying and multiplying and multiplying, and things are going to end up like Soylent Green. Soylent Green is the essential Malthusian worldview of a world that, you know, as we go forward, people just multiply and multiply and multiply and become increasingly impoverished, and the resources will be used up, and that'll be the end of the line for the human race. Well, 40 years later, that doesn't seem to be the case. And yes, there's poverty, war, competition for scarce resources, but actually the standard of living in the world has improved dramatically since the time of Soylent Green in 1973, 40 years ago. So I think Soylent Green takes the Malthusian worldview to an absurd length. But let's put that aside, you know, the concerns about the environment, which are valid. There's simply not much evidence that phony eggs will enhance people's health. And I cite an article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which clearly indicates, by the way, it just came out this summer. It's entitled Egg Consumption in Relation to Risk of Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And it was shown that egg consumption had absolutely no relationship to cardiovascular risk, none at all. So this actually squares with a lot of research, and I've shared it with you here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast and on my radio show, Health Talk, that confirms that cholesterol and saturated fats from meats and full-fat dairy do not actually clog arteries and lead to heart attacks and strokes. I'm sorry, you know, it's a misplaced emphasis. It's a myth that is what's driving our epidemic of cardiovascular disease. It's more about refined carbohydrates and harmful synthetic trans fats and poor quality omega-6 oils in our diet and nutritionally bereft processed food. So it turns out that, you know, what they used to call, remember that ad campaign, the incredible edible egg? It's actually a perfect nutritional package. It contains all the nutrients in correct balance because it's designed to nurture the growing embryo. So it all has to be there. Protein, the right amount of fat, certain other nutrients. Additionally, eggs are nature's best source of lutein, which is essential for eye health. Also choline, critical for brain and liver health. So this big project, I mean, look, these guys, they want to change the world. They have a big impact. You know, they already had a big impact on our lives because they've invented computers and they've changed the way that we exchange information for better or for worse. I mean, Bill Gates, for all the benefits he's created for us, he's probably been cursed by more people when a blue screen pops up on their computer than any other single living human being. So he wants to move on to, you know, now that he's changed our information environment, he wants to change our global environment and improve the health of humans across the world, especially in third world countries. But, you know, if there's one immutable law, it's the law of unintended consequences. So you got these well-heeled philanthropists who are looking to save the world. They sometimes do more harm than good, inadvertently, but still, that's the end result. And from a nutritional perspective, deleting a major source of cholesterol and fat from the diet of tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people worldwide might have far-reaching unforeseen health consequences. The developing brain needs cholesterol. Saturated fat may be an important calorie source for people across the world. And so instead, we're going to make low-fat or no-fat egg substitutes. And, you know, even from what's called a microeconomic perspective, let's look at the reality on the ground. We have small villages where people raise chickens, and they've been doing that in a traditional way for thousands of years. And now along comes this big company and says, look, you don't have to, you're wasting scarce resources, and you're doing it the old-fashioned way, raising those chickens and eating those eggs. And besides, the eggs are bad for you. So we're going to offer you these new crops that you can plant. And, oh, by the way, in order to take these relatively inedible plant products and process them into egg-like substances. We've got to build big factories in your country. And that's going to be good because there'll be a lot of foreign investment, there'll be a lot of jobs there. But also, these new productive plants are patentable and profitable for their makers, just like GMOs. And they create dependency of local farmers on distant companies. They literally can alter the entire economic setup, taking it from a traditional economy to a more technologically dependent economy, particularly dependent on the West. And so what we may have is local farmers dependent on distant companies, which offer them exotic seed crops, and then teach them how to process the stuff into, well, not Soylent Green, but some concoction that's supposed to feed the multitudes. And the self-sufficient farmers with barnyard kitchen chickens may lose out to these vast industrialized enterprises and giant processing plants. And how is that progress? Admittedly, we're not turning people into high-protein wafers. But, are we messing with the perfect human diet? And are we messing with the local ecology in ways that have unforeseen unforeseen consequences? That's all I'm saying. Great, kudos to them. They're trying to do all these wonderful humanitarian things, spend their money to help the world. But are these worthwhile products? Beyond eggs? Beyond meat? I don't think that's necessarily progress. We'll talk about that 111-year-old woman's secret to a long life in just a moment. But here's a reminder. Keep these podcasts flowing. If you enjoy the information that we share with you here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, what fuels these podcasts is your patronage of the store at drhoffman.com. So here's a pitch and a plea for you to go to drhoffman.com, check out our products, and order them. Order them for yourself, order them for your family. We've got a wide selection of health products available, wonderful supplements, and also great prices because we have a price match policy there. So if you say, well, this is a boutique-y place, I can get it cheaper at a discount online vitamin website. Think again because, well, first, our products, frankly, they are high quality, so they may be priced a little higher, but they are the very highest quality. And if you can find products of equivalent quality elsewhere on the web, let us know. We'll meet the price challenge. We don't want to gouge you. We simply want you to get the best quality products and still keep our enterprise afloat. So, your purchases at drhoffman.com at the store. Click on our dispensary there. These very self-same products that our patients get at the Hoffman Center when we see them, and we offer many of them to the general public at drhoffman.com. All right, now, very interesting story. This comes to us from a British tabloid. But I think it's for real. I think this is for, it's not a hoax. They show a picture of 111-year-old Dorothy Peel. Actually, the picture that they show is no fair because the picture was taken when she was 103. So it's a little bit, more optimistic picture. Because, it's like if I post a picture, I'm 60 years old, but I post a picture on the internet, when I'm 50, I'm going to look more youthful, more buff, right? But nonetheless, Dorothy Peel just celebrated her 111th birthday yesterday. And the picture, I wish you could see it. It shows her hefting a big glass of sherry. This is when she was a few years younger. And she says that her secret to a long life was 20 cigarettes a day and a pint of sherry for breakfast. Now, the interesting part is that she smoked steadily until the age of 103, and then her doctor warned her that She needed to stop smoking, so she quit. She got bronchitis, and the doctor said that if she kept smoking, she was going to die. So she stopped. Here it is now, 8 years later, and she's celebrating her 111th birthday. So, you know, it seems to have been good advice. She says, I drank regularly throughout the day, and in the morning I had half a pint of sherry, for lunch a gin and tonic, and around 7 p.m. a small ginger ale with a bit of whiskey. These days, she's 111. She admits, I just have a sherry now and then. She's cutting back. So she says, so much for smoking and drinking isn't good for you. I am living proof that a little of what you fancy does you good. And here's another secret. This is an important secret to her health and longevity. She says, I think not having had kids has helped. That's probably why I look and feel so good. I don't see anything in the article about whether she's been married or has a husband, because that's usually having a wife generally makes men live longer, but having a husband generally curtails the longevity of women. It seems to be, it's not a two-way street when it comes to longevity among spouses. She lives in East Yorkshire, England. She actually vividly remembers the sinking of the Titanic, which happened in, what was that, 1912, right? So I guess it's possible that she was 111. I don't know. And she also remembers being bombed out during the war, that being the World War II. She says everyone was really shocked when the Titanic sank. There was sadness everywhere. I've lived through two world wars. In the second, the shelter I was in was bombed, and I was really scared. A bomb fell next door, and my neighbors were killed. That was sad. She, according to her, her personal, she has a, health assistant. She's wonderful. She's independent, loves to choose her own clothes and dress herself. She will not wear slippers. She insists on wearing her bespoke court shoes with a 2-inch heel. She's very elegant and knows her own mind. And at 111, she is actually not the oldest woman in Great Britain. The oldest woman in the United Kingdom is Grace Adelaide Jones, who is 113. Now, my comment on this. Okay, does this give you license to smoke and drink yourself into oblivion? Well, let's look at those two factors, and let's look at what studies show. Studies show that smoking is an absolute downer on your longevity, 100%. Now, does that mean for each and every single individual who smokes that they will get cancer or they will get a premature heart attack? And the answer is no, but they will have a decidedly increased risk of those diseases. But there are some people who escape the ravages of those diseases. They also may escape the ravages of emphysema, pulmonary disease, which can also be a life-shortening ailment. And so what it is that there must be something about this lady that makes her immune, gives her sort of a Teflon-like protection against the very harmful effects of smoking. Smoking, clearly a negative factor for the vast majority of us, according to, and all the studies confirm that. When it comes to drinking, and I got, you know, I get a lot of flack when I share this with our listening audience, because there are people out there who are absolutely, they're absolutely committed to sobriety and to condemning the use of alcohol. And for very good reason, because they may have experienced personal problems, family problems, tragedies, drunk driving accidents, you name it, cirrhosis of the liver. All these problems are directly related to the use of alcohol, you know, suicide, murder, homicide, mayhem. But the vast majority of studies, if you look at the correlation between lifestyle factors, you know, exercise will make you live longer. Stopping smoking will make you live longer. Eating a better diet will make you live longer. But when it comes to curtailing alcohol use, it turns out that moderate drinkers actually tend to live longer. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately because this may give people license to drink more, there's almost no limit to the protective effects of drinking. People drinking quite large amounts generally do pretty well. And that to people who compile health statistics, that is dismaying. We don't want that message to get out. Like, oh, yeah, you know, encourage people to drink because we have so many kids these days who are binge drinking. And that's a big concern for especially young women because young women may be placing themselves at much higher risk of breast cancer because too much alcohol increases continuous exposure to estrogen. That may increase the risk of breast cancer. That's not a good thing for a young woman who is already has high levels of cancer-promoting estrogen. So, you know, what do we take away from instances like this? Look, I mean, I have somebody like this in my own family. He lived to a mere 101. My grandfather, who was not a model of health, he ate all kinds of heavy foods. He loved to eat steak and lobster slathered in butter and sauces, and wasn't a big candy eater, interestingly. Wasn't overweight, which is very important. When it came to stress, he was angry all the time. Whenever he went driving, he would just swear it. He would swear at the other drivers and get totally stressed out. I don't know how he didn't get a stroke. But they say that he didn't get a heart attack. He gave heart attacks. He's that kind of guy. And when it came to exercise, I mean, nothing like formal exercise. Occasionally, though, when I was a little kid, I would glimpse him. He would get out of the shower, and he would do like a little light calisthenics, like, you know, people used to do in the old days. You know, he would have his black socks on and his boxer shorts, and he would touch his toes, and he would do a little stretching. And that's about it. When it came to smoking, he smoked like a chimney. And then in his 80s, he stopped smoking cigarettes, and he just smoked an occasional cigar. And then I guess by the time he was 90 or so, either his doctor told him stop smoking cigars or he lost interest in cigars. And he survived until he was 101. So, you know, is you know, just like life. Have you noticed life is not a merit system? Prosperity is not necessarily a merit system. Success is not necessarily a merit system. There's a rough correlation. You know, what you put in is what you get out, but not always. And the same thing, unfortunately, when it comes to health. Health is only very partially, a merit system. That is, unless you are Dorothy Peel, who is celebrating her 111th birthday. Happy birthday, Dorothy. Okay, so let's take a look at our nutraceutical of the day, and that is peppermint. Lots of you are enjoyers of herbal tea, and peppermint tea is always a nice, refreshing type of herbal tea to take. But when it comes to health benefits, there are some real properties of peppermint that we should keep in mind. And I'm actually doing some research for a presentation I'm doing on natural treatments for gastrointestinal problems. And one of the herbs that I wanted to highlight was peppermint. So what is peppermint? Well, first of all, there's a whole category of herbs that are good for the GI tract that are referred to in herbal medicine as carminatives. Carminatives. Carminatives' main action is to soothe the gut wall, easing griping pains or colic. Colic is another word for spasm of, you know, you could have gallbladder colic. That's spasm of the gallbladder. You could have a spasm of the intestine. And these are painful and may cause you to feel uncomfortable. Often they're related to a condition called irritable bowel syndrome. So carminatives have a soothing effect They ease griping pains and reduce the production of gas in the digestive tract. Why is it? Well, this is usually due to the complex of volatile oils that are present, which have a local anti-inflammatory and anti-spasmodic effect. And also, they are mildly antimicrobial. They actually can retard the growth of bacteria in the intestinal tract. So let's drill down and look at some of these properties of peppermint. Peppermint oil, in particular, it's a real concentrate of peppermint. And you can get peppermint in various ways. You can make peppermint tea, or you can get peppermint capsules, or you can get tinctures of peppermint, or you can get pure peppermint oil. And I'll comment on that in a little while, because you may not want to use the pure peppermint oil. You may want to get it in enteric-coated capsules, capsules that break down further down in your gastrointestinal tract. But what happens when you test out scientifically the properties of peppermint? Well, it has inhibitory effects on a wide range of bacteria, gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria that can inhabit the intestinal tract. I mean, we need bacteria, but it turns out that bad bacteria can cause problems. There's a traditional use of peppermint tea for infectious diarrhea. It seems to, quote, soothe the stomach. Peppermint is effective even against multi-drug resistant strains of bacteria, which is kind of cool because we now have what's called bacterial resistance, superbugs, that no longer respond to our traditional antibiotics. And so it's kind of cool that peppermint, that these bacteria have not developed resistance to peppermint, and particularly a strong concentrate of peppermint, like peppermint oil, can actually inhibit and kill some of these nasty bacteria that no longer respond to antibiotics. In addition, and this has been tested scientifically, peppermint oil is effective against 25 fungal species. Why is that important? Well, Candida, the yeast connection, these are fungi, but even Candida that is resistant to traditional antifungal medications like ketoconazole, Nizoral, Diflucan, fungi are very hard to kill, and they can cause gas and bloating in the intestine. They actually turn the intestine into a distillery, making gas in the form of carbon dioxide bubbles and turning literally your carbohydrate food into alcohol, causing auto-brewery syndrome or a fermentation syndrome with toxic byproducts like aldehydes, making you feel drunk or unfocused or lousy. We recently reviewed on Health Talk the story of a guy who was walking around intoxicated, and his wife, who was a nurse, said, "Let me do a breathalyzer test on you," and it turned up four times the level that was permissible for driving. She said, "You've been hitting the bottle," and he said, "No," and she didn't believe him. Finally, they went to a doctor, and the doctor said to the wife, and you know, in confidence, said, "Look, you know, your husband, somehow he's sneaking the booze. We'll have to put him on a metabolic ward in the hospital and see what happens when we take him, when we completely isolate him." Well, he was still producing a breathalyzer test that was way over the limit. It turned out that he had yeast in his intestinal tract that was fermenting his carbohydrate foods into alcohol. So this yeast connection, a very valid and still viable theory. What can you do to suppress yeast? Well, there are many natural plant compounds that suppress yeast. But peppermint is one of them, and the peppermint in your peppermint tea will do it to some extent, but the peppermint from in a more concentrated form, peppermint oil, is ideal for suppressing fungal overgrowth. Also, peppermint has actually been used as an alternative to prescription antibiotics in the treatment of something called SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. They're actually antibiotics. One of them that's a multi-million dollar seller is called Xifaxan, but some of the bugs are developing resistance to Xifaxan. In a recent study, they found that peppermint oil was as effective as this popular antibiotic in suppressing harmful bacterial growth in the small intestine, thus reducing cramping, bloating, diarrhea, and the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome in people with small intestine bacterial overgrowth. So what's another way that peppermint helps the gastrointestinal tract? Well, it actually directly works on smooth muscle contractions. And they've done experiments where they've applied peppermint oil in various concentrations to smooth muscle. Smooth muscle, different than skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is right now, you know, make a fist. When you make a fist, you're using your skeletal muscle. It's voluntary muscle. You can say, make a fist, you make a fist. Relax the fist, your brain tells you to relax the fist. But smooth muscle is present internally in your body in various places, particularly in your intestinal tract. It also lines your arteries. But directly in the intestinal tract, when peppermint oil comes in contact with a smooth muscle in your intestinal tract, it relaxes that muscle. So that's kind of cool. That's going to work really well for people who have spastic bowel. They have spasm of the smooth muscle in their intestines, and this is going to cause them to have a lot of cramping and pain and sometimes diarrhea and urgency. So it's a very cool application of peppermint oil. And we suggest, and now we're coming to the crux of the matter, that people take enteric-coated peppermint oil because in England, it actually has a name. It's called Colpermin. Here, enteric-coated peppermint oil is available in various forms. We have it at drhoffman.com. Here's a study on peppermint oil in irritable bowel syndrome. Patients took one capsule of enteric-coated peppermint oil 3 to 4 times daily, 15 to 30 minutes before meals for 1 month. And what they found is that of the 41 patients taking enteric-coated peppermint oil, they experienced an alleviation of the severity of abdominal pain. 29 of 41 were pain-free. 83% had less abdominal distension. 83% had reduced stool frequency. 73% had fewer borborygmi. That's a fancy word for a stomach growling. And 79% reported less flatulence. So the conclusion is that symptom improvements after peppermint oil were significantly better than after placebo, because this was a placebo-controlled trial. Now, the problem is that peppermint has some side effects because it so significantly relaxes smooth muscle. It may relax the muscle that separates your esophagus from your stomach. This is called the gastroesophageal junction or the gastroesophageal sphincter, where you keep your stomach contents from refluxing upwards because of a tight band of smooth muscle that closes off that opening. And if you relax that opening, then you're going to get reflux. So peppermint oil turns out to be good for lower abdominal problems if you have spasm in your intestine. But if you have GERD or heartburn, it may actually make it worse. So side effects of peppermint, mouth irritation because it's, you know, it's sharp and spicy. GERD or heartburn can be made worse. You can, if it passes through you quickly, you may actually get anal burning. That's been reported. It's likely safe in pregnancy, but, you know, maybe a precaution or two would be in order. Here's a problem is if you take enteric-coated capsules and if they dissolve in your stomach instead of in your intestine, you may have burning in your stomach. And one of the reasons that you're going to be more likely to have your enteric-coated capsules stick in your stomach is if you take an antacid. You're already taking an acid-blocking medication like Nexium or Prilosec. May not be the greatest idea to take enteric-coated peppermint. Or also, if you have a condition which occurs in diabetics, gastroparesis, which is a slowdown of your digestive tract, maybe these enteric-coated peppermint oil capsules, not the best idea. And there's some drug interactions. So if you're taking high-dose peppermint oil and you're on prescription drugs, check with your pharmacist for possible reactions. Peppermint oil may actually increase the level of certain drugs, statin drugs, certain antihypertensive drugs. There is the possibility of a drug interaction with peppermint. So that's it for our nutraceutical of the day. And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks for joining us. And make sure you continue listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. As you know, you can get them from drhoffman.com. You can also subscribe via iTunes. And also, if you want additional content, go to WR710.com and check out our podcasts of the Health Talk radio program. They're also there. Subscribe to our newsletter, radio program at AOL.com. Visit our store at drhoffman.com. Make sure you check out our nice array of products there. Help support and subsidize these podcasts to keep them flowing. That's what fuels this enterprise. And join us again for our upcoming program. Going to be very exciting. We're going to be talking to Lauren Cordain, who is the originator of the Paleo Diet. That should be a great interview coming up on our next Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.